This is 3P Theory, the podcast for AEC professionals seeking to elevate their knowledge on green building strategies and practical design collaboration for sustainable mindsets, bringing you change makers, innovators, and sustainable leaders who have positively impacted the industry. It's time to get inspired, motivated, and fired up to take action towards a greener planet. Here's your host, Mike Brown.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of the 3P Theory podcast. It's a great day, and I'm really excited to share with you a very interesting guest who's going to share with us some info about an emerging rating system that I recently heard about, at least here in the United States, that I think is a real opportunity for buildings to take advantage of some of the air quality aspects in creating a healthy environment. And so with that, we want to bring on today Stanton Wong, who is the president of Reset. Welcome, Stanton.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Great. Great to have you. So obviously, you understand our situation and some of the challenges that, you know, COVID-19 has brought about with buildings and being able to transition workers back to the office and things of that nature. But even aside from that, I want to focus on Reset. Tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you transitioned into that role with Reset.
So my background is not actually related to environment, and it's not related to architecture. I'm a computer science and film double major. And when I graduated, I was working at a computer science related job. So I was an engineer. And after starting a company in New York, I was traveling the world and stopped by Shanghai, where my mother's from. And a friend of mine from first grade was working at Giga, which is the mother company of Reset. And it was, I guess, by luck that I ended up joining the company. And I was just fascinated by the concept of using architecture and buildings to create health for people. So that kind of pulled me in, and the role was very interesting. The team was very small, so we were very active. Everyone participated and had a big role in things. So, yeah, that's how I got started here.
Great, great. You know, it's interesting to see how people may have backgrounds that aren't necessarily relevant to maybe what they're doing today, but still having a huge impact, which is kind of almost similar to my story in a way, in terms of just different fields of engineering. So it's interesting to see that. So with Reset, tell us a little bit about what it all means and kind of what can owners expect from achieving that particular certification in the marketplace?
Yeah. So Reset starts off with air quality, and it's the quickest way to describe what Reset is. It's a standard around data for the built environment. So the first module we built, and the one that we focus on the most so far, has been air quality. And the way it works is we require a space to monitor air quality continuously. And we use that data to verify whether or not a space is healthy. So we set performance targets for a space. We set the rules for how many monitors you need in the space. And we take all that data, we put it into our own system that does auditing. And then we report back whether or not you're achieving the standard from a performance target perspective.
I see. Yeah, that's pretty important. And I speak from a perspective of maybe similar rating systems or programs that somewhat focus on air quality. However, the very opposite of what you guys are doing is that they may focus on the front end. While it is important from a new construction standpoint or even a renovation standpoint, and just setting the standard for, or even improve standards on top of normal air quality as it relates to things like ASHRAE 62.1 or minimum ventilation, especially when you're dealing with natural ventilation scenarios and things of that nature. But I think what you guys are touching on with being able to track and monitor that is very critical, because as we all know, you know, the moment that the building gets turned over, whether it's from, you know, developer to another owner or even just in a real estate transaction, in many cases, the facilities management team and things of that nature may transition as well. But even just from the beginning of a building and throughout the life cycle of a building, if things aren't necessarily monitored and handled from a maintenance standpoint, it starts to degrade, right?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. We define ourselves as an operational standard. So it's really about long-term tracking how the maintenance teams are doing and just being aware of how to optimize for the building with data.
Definitely. And I think I may have mentioned this before about, you know, how, you know, there are existing buildings that, you know, once they get turned over, the facilities folks, you know, dial down the outside air dampers or shut them down completely, which can compromise obviously the ventilation, but also the health of the occupants. And, you know, this is a way to really create transparency around that for the occupants as well. So I think that's pretty neat. And because in those scenarios, and feel free to shed some light on it as well, in terms of sick building syndrome, and, you know, obviously over time as it starts to compound on itself in terms of the poor air quality, eventually people will start to feel that. What are some of the things that you've seen, I guess, in some of the existing buildings that have helped identify certain strategies or pathways within the RESET program?
I'll give a few examples of what we've seen RESET in terms of how RESET has helped projects. So one of the reasons that people have sick building syndrome is actually because of chemicals in the air indoors. So material choices, especially varnishes, glues, anything that can off-gas, can off-gas into the air. So VOCs, volatile organic compounds, is the term for this. And so formaldehyde is the most commonly talked about one. Benzene is another. And especially, so we started in China, where there's a lot more issues in the past 10 years of bad material choices. And so our goal was to be able to monitor and make sure that once people move in and after the flush out phase, that the indoor environment was actually kept healthy from an air quality perspective. So having monitors in place was really helpful for certain spaces to be able to guarantee that the space was actually clean. In addition, there's been situations where people have written into the contract that they will be doing RESET certification after people move in. So for the construction team, they had to really consider their material choices, especially if they were changing materials that were not specified by the design team.
Definitely. Yeah, I've seen a fair share of that. my time in the industry, you know, when it comes to doing value engineering and things of nature in the field, some of that stuff can change, and it may not be comparable apples to apples in terms of not only quality, but as you mentioned, the VOC content and things of that nature.
Yeah,
so that's pretty important. So with that, I mean, I know you mentioned starting out in China, and you guys have recently started to really be aggressive in terms of growth here in the United States. What are some of the challenges that you've seen with the adoption of that program here in the United States? Understanding that, you know, there are, you know, other programs that offer, you know, a piece or a category for air quality. What have you seen so far?
I'll start with the difficulties. The difficulties, I think, for air quality, because our current approach has been just air quality. So we don't include anything else in our standard or certification. The hard part has been that health is hard to measure from an ROI perspective. Like, you can invest in air quality, but you don't know how it's affecting, you don't immediately know how it's affecting your employees' health. You also don't immediately know how, whether or not there's any productivity gains, even though there's been research, the COGFX research done by Harvard. It's just not obvious. So if you were looking at investing in your space for your employees, air quality is not the most obvious one, just because it's you can't measure it as well. And the second is you cannot, you don't really see it. I think the second part that's really hard is air quality is not something that's been traditionally kind of managed, because you didn't have the data before. And so because our standard is focused on operational and continuous monitoring and versus a one-time check, it's a lot harder to achieve than other standards, because it's not like, you know, your test is over and you're done, but you're going to be constantly measured throughout the rest of time as long as you're trying to do the standard.
Yeah, I want to take a step back on that because I think you said something really, really, I guess, profound, which I try to resonate with a lot of folks, is the quote that, you know, you can't manage what you don't measure. So it's really interesting to see that you guys are applying that from to an air quality perspective, very similar to an energy perspective when we're looking at energy performance for a building.
Yes.
I think that is the bottleneck in many cases for people, you know, achieving that next level of performance is being able to do that piece there. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. The one good thing, I think the reason why we've been getting a lot of interest from North America is very much because of COVID-19. And I think most people realize that one of the main reasons or main methods it transmits from a person to another person is through air, specifically respiratory fluids. So whenever we speak, whenever we cough, we're essentially emitting aerosols from our mouths into the air. And the aerosols or the respiratory fluids can stay airborne for a good amount of time. So if you can actually control air quality, you can decrease the amount of time these particles are in the air. And so that lowers the transmission risk.
That's one of the things that I think a lot of owners, especially, you know, people that have tenants are really trying to focus on right now and have concerns only because they're trying to rebuild that trust for people to come back into the office. So I think that, you know, as one of those potential strategies, along with, you know, cleaning protocols and things of that nature, this could be very viable. And then also just to try to put a pulse on ongoing air quality, right? Even beyond looking at, you know, viruses and bacteria and things of that nature. And I want to get your perspective on this as well, because I think about this sometimes from a sustainability standpoint, overarching is, you know, with things like this, and along with sustainability, I don't know if you're familiar with the kind of early adopters curve. I can't remember what it's called, but basically, you know, it's a kind of bell curve that shows, you know, innovators, which is a smaller percentage at the beginning, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and then you have the laggards that, you know, people that come on at the very, very end and say, oh, I understand it now, but it's kind of too late kind of yeah. Thing. Where do you feel we fall in that spectrum from an air quality perspective and kind of doing something like this? Are we still in that early adopters phase, or are we even farther back than that in terms of innovators?
I think we're actually closer to innovators, because if we look at the number of buildings, or even the number of, let's just say number of buildings. The number of buildings who actually care about air quality is very few. So traditionally, air quality has just been the number of, it's calculated by CFM, right? Just how much fresh air you're bringing into the building. But that's really a proxy for good air quality based on numbers that you can leverage from a design perspective before having sensors. So it's a very 20th century approach to air quality. From a 21st century perspective, where you now have technology and sensors, I think very few companies, very few buildings have figured out how they want to approach it. And what we've seen is every single building is different. Every single building has legacy systems that are different. So every single solution for achieving RESA certification is different. Because for us, we only have the rules for how you monitor. We don't have specific rules for how you solve the problem. And so the reason we did that was because we realized that if we set rules, we're essentially a design standard, which doesn't make sense from looking at the wide range of buildings that are out there.
I see. And with that monitoring with sensors, is that something that is shared with your program from all the people that participate on a quarterly basis, annual basis? And is that public data, or is that, how does that work?
Yeah. So we have something called the RESA Cloud, and the RESA Cloud every project is required to send data to the RESA Cloud. And the way it works is we require data to be sent at least once every day. If you want to have it be even more continuous, it would be every 30 minutes. So we collect 30-minute average data, And we take that data every day and calculate through it. And then the way the standard certification works is we have an algorithm that basically parses it into a monthly pass and fail. And so we actually take data a lot more often than most other standards, because we expect it to be connected by API. We expect everything to be automated so that there's no chance of human error in the middle for the process of passing over the data. And that's how we believe that in the future data should be handled for buildings. It should be all automated. You shouldn't have to expect someone to be helping you pull a CSV or whatever to get data for it.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And I think by having that ease of access to, streamlining that access and data collection, hopefully really eliminates some barriers, or at least perceived barriers, I think, that a lot of people have around getting that information and sharing it with transparency too, right? It would be interesting, you know, how, and I've seen something similar to this on the energy performance side from a real estate perspective. And maybe that's a question then. Have you seen this transition into a true valuation, or adding to the quote unquote balance sheet for real estate transactions as people are seeking out new real estate opportunities, whether it's a property or a portfolio of properties? Or is that information not available as a part of the review process unless the owner specifically brings it out?
Wait, so I don't really understand the question. Right. When you say valuation, are you saying like, does this come into play for how they consider valuation of the building? Like whether or not they're doing air quality?
Yeah, so very similar to if you were looking at, say, a LEED platinum building versus a LEED gold building kind of thing. Are you starting to see that this starts to fold into the valuation process?
Yeah. So there's definitely interest in trying to figure out how to fold it in. And it's still an ongoing process. I think the hardest part right now has been to figure out how much does this cost just as an investment, not even from a longer term perspective. Because again, the hardest part with air quality is the long-term measurement or calculation of how much it's worth. Right now, we are working with a bunch of property owners, really more on pilots. So piloting an entire building for one of their properties so that they can figure out how much it would cost to do the portfolio. Because there's a lot of interest in figuring out how to do good air quality. And although not measurable now, we are seeing case studies of essentially high-end tenants who choose a building that has good air quality. So there are cases in Shanghai that we know of where very high-end tenant left an older building when their lease was done and moved to a building that was actually recently certified.
Gotcha. Okay. That's good to hear. I mean, very similar to some of the other rating systems, you know, there's always that kind of ramping up period when people are, you know, understanding the program, understanding the value, the strategies. And really, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about the intent and the strategies as opposed to necessarily the program itself, regardless of what it is, just because the program obviously offers some structure to streamline and really create an apples to apples comparison, looking at one building compared to another, right?
Yep. And speaking of comparing, one of the things that I want to actually talk about really quickly is that RESET standard comes in two parts. There's RESET for commercial interiors and RESET for core and shell. And I think it's important to make this distinction where the reason initially we started with just commercial interiors, which is just indoor spaces. And what we did was for this, for commercial interiors, the goal was just to measure the space that people are actually occupying. After we did this for a year, we had a client come in and say, hey, a building owner come in and say, one of our tenants are telling us that we're delivering bad air quality to them. How can we show them that that's not the case? And so we went in, we worked on designing a sensor that can be put into the HVAC system and measure how good the air quality is being delivered into a space instead of the space itself. And after measuring for a couple months, we realized that the building's HVAC system is delivering excellent air. So passes our standard completely, while the space of the tenant was encountering problems. So what we realized was that there were material choice issues, and there were also other issues within the interior space that was generating pollution. And so we went in there and tried to help solve the problem that way. And one of the biggest reasons this is important is because two things. One, you can start defining with a common language who's responsible for what part of the air quality. And the second thing is, from a landlord's perspective, you don't lose, but you handle liability issues.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing that you brought up that I hadn't thought about before. And feel free if you've got some experiences that you want to talk about, or a case that you were involved in where that was became a major issue. Is, you know, with things now with COVID-19 and kind of you know, the fear that people have around spaces being healthy enough to reoccupy, what kind of, is there real liability or risk if, well, let me put it like this. I guess there's very little if there isn't full transparency, right? Because yeah. You can share information with people and say, hey, we're cleaning on this schedule, things of that nature. But when it really comes down to it, if you're in a more robust kind of framework where you are monitoring, you're sharing that data, then, you know, I can see how that could be, I can see how that could scare some building owners about having that level of transparency. Because the information not only has to be shared with you guys, but also the tenants and the occupants, right?
Yeah. So the reset standard and certification requires you to share the daily data with your occupants. And the reason behind that is because transparency is key. And I think that the goal is communication and trust. So far, we've actually seen very few companies fully leverage what reset can do for them. And it's the communication and trust part. There is data being sent to us. That's actually not the most important part. And also, just to answer a previous question, we don't make that publicly accessible unless you want that data to be publicly accessible. But the sharing of the data with occupants and building communication and trust, that's key, because part of what we want to do is for people to understand that it's not about having 100% uptime for good air quality. It's about being able to show that you care about the occupants in the space, that you are measuring it and you're sharing it so that you can show, oh, if there is any issue, if you spot anything and let us know, we will fix it. Because, I mean, we're all an engineer. We know things happen, like things break, right?
Yeah.
You have more eyes on it, then you're going to fix it much faster.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's the old adage that the squeaky wheel, you know, gets the grease, so the oil, right?
Yeah. So I think it's all about communication. Like, I think a lot of property owners are afraid of showing any form of weakness, anything that might show that they made a mistake. But I think we need to own our mistakes. We need to be able to say, oh, yeah, we made the mistake. We're going to fix it right away. The quick response is more important than hiding everything. I think that's why, like, transparency to us is such a big thing, and communication and trust is such a big thing.
Yeah, no, that's a really good nugget there. I'm going to definitely play that back for our listeners, because I think that really leverages the leadership opportunity that they have as well by doing something like this. And hopefully, as the reset program progresses and grows, more and more people will start to see that. You know, you guys have certified quite a few properties and obviously have a ton in the pipeline right now. Is there any, I guess, upcoming changes that people can look forward to in maybe a newer version of updates to look forward to, considering everything that's going on right now? Or is that kind of a more long-term plan?
So in the short term, we've been working on an index to kind of reflect the preparation that buildings can do for COVID-19. So humidity is obviously a very big talking point right now for COVID-19, maintaining a proper relative humidity in an indoor space. One thing that we stress is that it doesn't make sense to try to humidify the entire building through the HVAC system, because that potentially leads to Legionnaire's disease and all that when you humidify the ducts too much. So I think humidity is a more localized per commercial interior space kind of solution that needs to be handled. Fresh air obviously is handled by the building, and So our goal is to create an index that leverages continuous and live data to show what the building is doing for the space to maintain the optimal air quality to lower the risk of transmission. So this is obviously on top of doing what's necessary from a cleaning perspective and a policy perspective for how people enter the building. But taking this extra step would be able to create additional trust with occupants.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's important, and this is one of the things I mentioned before about layering on those strategies, because it's not a one-size-fits-all, right? And I think that, you know, this really embodies a lot of those concepts around understanding, you know, the certain space types within the building or even the building type and the scope of the work that's going to be done, that it lends itself to really optimizing that scenario. And then also understanding, obviously, who has that scope for the operational standpoint and handing it off or even having a shared responsibility between the tenant and the owner.
Yeah, completely agree. So to continue on the initial question for this, we're also looking at expanding our standards. So air quality is what we started with. And the reason we started air quality was because we're based in Shanghai. And in 2012, a documentary called Under the Dome came out. And it was about how PM2.5 levels were, or the fog that you saw outside was not actually fog. It's actually pollution. And how... the PM2.5 levels are actually in China. And so our company started off doing materials, so we had a very good understanding of how indoor air quality works. We realized that without some kind of monitoring for indoor spaces, you'll never know how bad the air is inside. And counter to popular belief, indoor air quality is typically worse than outdoor. So opening windows doesn't help the problem whatsoever, especially if PM2.5 is really high outside. And so that's how air quality started for us. And we essentially chose the hardest one that we could do. Now we're starting to explore pushing out an energy standard. And the main reason we've decided to do this is because we think there's a very huge cross-section between air quality and energy, because HVAC systems obviously take up a huge amount of energy. And it doesn't make sense for us to pollute the world more to make sure that we're making indoor air quality extremely, extremely good. So there has to be a balance, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And so we see that there's a lot of opportunities for optimizing air quality systems and the energy use. And so our next step is pushing out an energy standard to basically work with the air quality standard.
Awesome. I really do love that.
Yeah.
I look forward to that. I definitely want to stay updated on that.
Yeah. And so you can see for the rest of the year, we're going to be looking at expanding our number of standards, all focused on data, all about continuous monitoring. One of the most interesting ones in China is waste, because Shanghai has implemented really strict separation requirements. So for a couple months, they still have people at every single station for taking waste. And they require you to separate your waste into four different types. One is dry waste. One is wet waste, which is foodstuffs. And the other one's recycling. And the last one's medical and hazardous materials.
Hmm.
So they've gone really hardcore with that. And in China, at least in Shanghai, there's a lot of interest in starting to monitor waste. And so we're working with a company to figure out how we can develop a bin to just measure how much waste goes in and then get that number logged into a system so that we can track how much waste is being generated from a space.
Gotcha. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I know that a lot of folks are doing some innovative things with tracing and things of that nature as well. And this is kind of more specific to COVID-19 for spaces and through cameras and other thermal sensors and things of that nature. Is there any intent to have any integration with those types of technologies at all? Or is that kind of separate from this? Because I, I think, and you alluded to this before, you know, right now, obviously the whole world is focused on, you know, COVID, but there's a larger perspective or picture to look at with this. And so not to be too narrowly focused, but is that kind of an integration that you see emerging in the future?
For tracking people, we're not quite sure how to approach that yet, because from a standard, it's not something that a standard could really solve. We would be interested in looking at how to set a standard around occupancy, just like measuring how to get a standard around just how you measure people within the space. Actually, I'd like to ask, what are you guys doing for the tracking part, or what are you exploring?
Well, I have a relative that's in the, I guess, the security industry, and they work with, you know, different thermal cameras and things of nature, specialized cameras, whether it be for private entities or governmental entities that kind of track or will be tracking some of this stuff. And it's all centered around some of the technology that you've maybe seen before around cameras capturing license plates and facial recognition and things of that nature. And so kind of just that next level or next tier of that will be to kind of, you know, do tracing through thermal imaging. And then obviously if you have multiple cameras set up, you can kind of follow the path and understand who that person came in contact with, you know, for an indefinite amount of time, I guess, from when they contracted it and then the other people that are exposed as a part of that process. But I think what you're getting at though is that, you know, from an occupancy standpoint, you can start to monitor from a maybe utilization standpoint, and then also maybe, I don't want to say overcrowding of certain rooms, but if you have, you know, a protocol or a standard for that tenant space or within that building that, you know, only so many people can be within a particular space, and maybe, you know, 90% of the time it's over occupied, then maybe that could be a red flag, or, you know,
yeah.
Is that kind of what you're getting at? Or
sort of. I think the reason why, so from just a philosophical perspective, like having the standard is useful because it creates a common language. So it makes it so that you can do apples to apples comparison instead of having something, having two different types of occupancy systems trying to compare it. It makes it a lot harder. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily, with occupancy, it's not necessarily to say we want to make sure there's not enough people or there's not too many people in a space, but it's more of having the data so that you can figure out how to optimize a space for future use. So having the data, you understanding how people flow in the space or how people use the space makes it so that you understand how the space might need to be expanded, or it might need additional fresh air in a specific part of the space or a specific meeting room that's often overcrowded, that kind of stuff. It's more of a leverage the data to help you solve problems in the future.
Awesome. No, I love that.
Yeah. And I want to also kind of talk about what you were just talking about, the thermal cameras and tracking. For thermal cameras, actually, every single higher end building in China right now, or at least in Shanghai, from what I've seen, they're using thermal cameras to track the people who walk into a building to make sure there's no fevers.
Hmm.
And every single office has their own, what is it called? I have no idea what this is called. It's a thermal gun. It looks like a gun because it has a trigger. And
yeah, it's like the one that you use to take the temperature of food.
Yeah. So you point, they like to point it at people's foreheads, but you can do it on any part of the skin. And you just want to make sure the person doesn't have a fever. Because if they have a fever, then you're a little bit more worried, right? So that's what I was talking about earlier about entry protocols. So making sure that you know who's coming into the building, whether or not they have a fever. And thermal imaging and those thermal temperature checkers are very useful for that. For the tracking, this is really interesting because in China, they've implemented the health code, which uses the telecommunications system, because China controls all the telecommunications companies, to track where everyone's been. And so if they discover that one person is found to have COVID-19 or is showing symptoms, they will look for all the people who this person might have been in contact with. So just they would track where this person's been for the last 2 days, looking at telecommunication information. And then anybody who was within, I don't know, 50 meters of this person would also get essentially notified that they need to report to authorities. And also, if they were ever to show their health code, it would be either yellow or red. So green is the color that means you're good. And then if it's yellow or red, then something is wrong that you need to go report yourself.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I didn't know that it was that sophisticated. You know, it's hard to believe that, you know, in the United States, we don't have anything similar to that, at least on a large scale. And unfortunately, due to, you know, privacy laws and things of that nature. Yeah. But I think that hopefully that may be changing. But yeah, it also made me think about, you know, because I was going to ask, how quickly can they address those situations when they come up? You know, comparatively, I would expect this within a matter of, you know, a couple of minutes or maybe even an hour at most. But on the flip side, if you compared the same scenario to maybe an occupant here in the United States, I mean, it could be days, if not, I don't know how long, much, much longer before. And then by that time, those people that they've got in contact with are now affecting other people, and it explodes.
Yeah, it spirals really quick. Yeah, no, it's tough, because the other thing is there's a habit of everyone here wearing masks, and everyone's wearing masks not really because, well, first of all, the government told them to, so everyone's wearing masks. And it was initially when the masks was first introduced as a requirement, they actually had drones flying around the streets telling people to put on their masks. So that was interesting. And because for the young people, it's easy. We get news really quickly. But for the older people, they don't get access to news as easily just because they don't care as much. And so there were drones flying around, especially around Wuhan, that would have a camera and they would have a speaker controlling it. And they would literally fly next to a person and say, "Hey, why don't you have your mask on?" But anyways, the mask thing, I think, is very important right now, because it's really about controlling your respiratory fluids, so that if no one is, respiratory fluids into the air, then the amount of transmission will go down significantly. So in China right now, because everyone's still used to wearing it, even if someone is found to have symptoms, it's unlikely that they really pass on to too many people around them, because everyone's still in the habit of wearing masks.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. You know, the folks here in the United States, we're still transitioning, I feel, into the norm right now, at least of doing that. But it's gotten way better, at least in the past, at least from what I've seen in the past, you know, week or two. But, you know, you're always going to have those people that are rebellious and things of that nature. But
yeah, it's very much about education. I think when people started realizing that this was about protecting other people rather than protecting themselves, it was more obvious on why they should wear a mask. But when you tell them, "Oh, wear a mask and it'll protect you," they're like, I think a lot of people don't believe it.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you sharing, about the reset program. I think it's something that I know our team is going to be looking at on a couple of projects to hopefully implement, and really at the very least educating our clients about the program, the strategies and things of that nature, for really being able to elevate the performance and elevate the health of their buildings. And, you know, definitely as you all share information that you're able to share on your findings, definitely be on the lookout for that and share that with our listeners as well. Because I think that'll be a huge springboard, especially on top of all the other things that people are doing, whether it be, you know, through LEED or WELL and so on and so forth in the upcoming months or upcoming years.
Yeah. There's one more thing I wanted to share before we end. And it's the biggest project I worked on, which was, to me, quite innovative. And it's really taking communication and trust to the next level. And it's we were working on a project with Swire, who's a property developer out of Hong Kong. And they have a goal called Sustainability Development 2030, SD 2030. Mm-hmm. And we were working on a pilot with them last year. And the goal that we were trying to work with them on was their goal is to lower their energy consumption significantly. And what we realized when we were working with them on this was that to really decrease your energy consumption, you have to engage your tenants because your tenants are a large part of the energy consumption of a building because they take up the majority of the space. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do you work with them to lower their energy consumption as well? It's not like you can't just walk up to them and say, hey, we have this SD 2030 program, so we need you to lower your energy consumption. But it has to be something where you can interact with them, engage them, and kind of guide them towards this direction. And so what we worked with them on was something that we're calling the leaderboard, but it's essentially just benchmarking. We have their entire building monitored, and then we monitor each of their space, each of the tenant spaces. We did air quality and energy. And the goal of this was just to have this data all in one leaderboard. And with the leaderboard, we would be able to show the tenants where they placed. So from an energy perspective or from an air quality perspective, were they number one? Were they number 30? We didn't show the names of the other occupants, other tenants. Because we didn't want to build too much, it's not animosity, but like we don't want to make it too competitive. Right. But we wanted to show where they were. And the key to this was, first of all, Swire now has an opportunity to talk to their tenants about this. And the other thing is it incentivizes from a gamification perspective for different companies to potentially be interested in doing better. And the last part, I think that's really important, is with this data, you can show or you can see what is possible. Like the person who's number one, the tenant who's number one, they're definitely doing something right. So if you're the last place, you're going to be curious, what are they doing that's so different from us? Is there anything we can learn from them? And if we're talking about energy, you're saving money if you can lower your energy costs. If it's air quality, you're looking at long-term health benefits for your employees. And if you communicate that properly, you can build trust with your employees.
Yeah, no, I think that strategy with gamification is starting to be really emerging. And I like that you guys have started to kind of play that on the air quality perspective. I've seen similar things on the energy side before, but not on air quality. So that's really interesting. You know, one of the things which I'm not sure if there is any particular, I guess, significant penalty or significant reward, but I guess that varies on the building or build from building to building, right? In terms of how that engagement happens and kind of some of the incentives. But I guess the more educated the individuals are, obviously the less incentive you have to provide to push them in the direction that you want, right?
Yeah. And so just sharing this because I think it's powerful for the industry to start looking into gamification generally. How can we help people first be incentivized to do better? Having data in your face is a good way to start that. And the other thing we believe is it's important for us to build a strong community, which is something that I've been focusing on recently as having taken over as president. And the goal of it is to build a community where we can find the best solutions. Because for us, we're not a solutions company. Our standard also doesn't focus on solutions, but we think that we can design our case studies, the structure of our case studies, to really highlight the best solutions out there, both from a most optimal perspective and a more cost-efficient perspective, so that different people in the industry can pick and choose what makes the most sense for them.
I think that's a huge part, just because people want to have those options and not feel, you know, cornered into one particular stringent way of doing it. So, yeah. Well, great. And I'm glad you were able to share that. If there is any literature on that or a case study, definitely share that with me, and I'll make sure that gets posted, because that's something I probably want to read it in a little bit more on as well, about maybe something that we can, you know, try to bring in on a project that we're working on, or at least educate individuals about it. Because I mean, I think with that, you're really allowing the opportunity and potential to motivate those tenants through consistent participation and really just that long-term engagement, right?
Yeah. So the case study isn't out yet, mainly because parts of this is still ongoing, but we have the introductory presentation for kind of like the announcement of this project. So that can be shared.
Great. Well, I definitely enjoyed having you again, and look forward to keeping in touch on the evolution of that particular project, and then also with the growth of the rating system. And best of luck. Continue to stay safe, and hopefully we'll chat again soon.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 3P Theory with Mike Brown. If you like our show and want to know more, check out 3ptheory.com or please leave us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. Join us next time for more insightful knowledge on high-performance building design.